Horror fans, NabNew.com is your new destination for keeping up with the latest horror collectibles. At launch, NAB is aggregating 27 of the top online stores into one place so you can find the new releases of DVDs, toys, figures, comics, vinyl soundtracks, board games, and more. Simply follow your favorite horror properties and you'll get a custom feed with all the day's new releases that matter to you. And since we have everything in one place, you can easily compare prices across vendors, check stock availability, and nab it before it's gone. So NAB is more than just horror. You can follow everything from American Psycho to My Hero Academia. So we put together a special collection for Shockwaves fans. Visit nabnew.com/horror to check it out. That's nabnew, nabnew.com/horror. It's 2020 and Fangoria magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use the promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now. Tonight's episode is also brought to you by our friends at Vinegar Syndrome, and it's their wildest month of releases yet. The jaw-dropping early 80s Canadian Gore Fest Deadline makes its worldwide Blu-ray debut. Exploitation auteur Uli Lommel's bizarre mix of erotic thriller and slasher Olivia finally comes to Blu-ray in its actual uncut version, featuring bloodshed and nudity unseen in for over 35 years. And lastly, Andrea Bianchi's brain-busting X-rated take on The Exorcist, Malabimba, makes its uncut disc debut in a must-have Blu-ray. So what are you waiting for? Head over to VinegarSyndrome.com and get your orders in today. And while you're at it, be sure to sign up for their mailing list so you never miss another announcement or exclusive sale again. This week, Fright Rags has released 5 new long-sleeve shirts for popular titles such as Halloween, The Blair Witch Project, and more. Featuring all-new artwork and detailed sleeve prints, there is no better way to wear your love of horror on your sleeve. And also available this week, the all-time favorite Kill Destroyers design is back. Originally designed by Jason Edmondson back in 2013, it is now back for a limited time as a regular shirt or a tour-style baseball tee. Grab it while you can, all exclusively at fright-rags.com. And listeners, you can get 10% off your first order with the code WAVES10. That's WAVES10.
Hey guys, welcome to Shockwaves.
We, for those of you guys who are not familiar with us, we are a podcast that has been running for like 8 years now. We started out under the name Killer POV, and then Blumhouse purchased us, and we became Shockwaves. And we just recently went under the Fangoria banner.
So. Yeah. Any OG Killer POV listeners here? Yes.
Woo-hoo! So yeah, we've been doing this for a long time. But this week, we were looking for something a little bit different that we could do here. And we thought about all different types of lists that we can do because we like doing visual components when we come to festivals. Because that's one of the nice things when we sit in a room by ourselves, we just get to talk. But when we come to festivals, we get kind of this presentational thing. So we love doing visual components. And so we went through a bunch of different lists that we could potentially do before we decided on body horror. Because I had just done a technology portion of my other podcast, Nightmare University, and you had just done science fiction for your other podcast.
Hasn't come out yet, but yeah.
Hashtag always be podcasting.
Yeah, always be podcasting.
Always be podcasting. And so because we had watched a whole bunch of these films, we found ourselves talking about them a lot, and then it just kind of made sense because we had just watched a bunch of them.
Why don't we talk about something outrageous, how you feel about Body Parts, one of the greatest releases of the
year. Yeah. So this was really polarizing last week on the show.
Now, because can you guess who made the PowerPoint? And he's taunting her with that picture in the last episode.
Last week, Elric walks into the show and begins with, so we had a homework assignment where we all had to go watch Body Parts. And I had watched this on a date. It was probably one of my very first dates ever in the early 90s. I was still in middle school, which meant like we held hands and it was salacious. And my response, you came in and you were like, Body Parts, best film of the 90s. And I was like, really? There were a lot of films that came out in the 90s, man. I mean, like, Starship Troopers was 90s, and that was pretty good. Like, it was.
I couldn't remember any after I watched Body Parts again. It was like a quick amnesia.
Body Parts was not exactly my jam, but I did enjoy a lot of the body horror. So thank you for
still
putting me on blast for
so
my
if
body
you haven't
parts
seen Body Parts, so Body Parts will not be on the list, but if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's a very dark film, but it got a little silly for you.
It's got amusing moments. It did. It did get silly for me.
But before we jump into body horror, we saw some stuff at the festival. We'll go deeper on the weekly show. But what was like, did you have a pick of the fest? Because I know the fest keeps going beyond today. So for people to catch up to something, what was your
pick? I haven't seen a bad film yet. Like, and they're all of the ones that I've seen have just been absolutely ones that I love for different reasons. Like Sea Fever I saw on the first night here with you. And there's literally a moment in the film, it's a body horror moment, where I leaned over and I was like, I fucking love this. So just something explodes off somebody's body. And it was just kind of my favorite moment of the festival movies so far. Just because it tends to be those kind of explosive moments that I look for in cinema. So that one was absolutely incredible. And then the one that we saw yesterday morning, Disappearance at Clifton Hill.
Clifton Hill, yeah.
I loved as well. Like, that was just a super tight murder mystery.
But spoiler, as we walked out, I was like, oh, the death of cinema is here because David Cronenberg is in a movie playing a podcaster who says, please remember to rate and review.
The whole time.
And
like,
it just brought me existential dread to my soul.
He's in the movie a lot, and he's playing this kind of fringe theory podcaster. And yeah,
who are the guys in X-Files? Who are the crazy the
smoking guns?
No, the crazy ones. The ones who have theories.
Law enforcement.
He's one of those guys. He's basically one of those guys.
I knew
guys.
They had a name.
We should always do the show live. We'll get all our information.
That's Stacy. We love Stacy. Yeah. She runs Etheria. She's been on before. Yes. No, you've been on. You were on Killer POV. Oh, Heidi was. That was it. So
for me, there was a film called Swallow that if you get a chance to see, it doesn't fit as cleanly into, say, horror, but it's like we're just saying existential dread and definitely body horror. When the body is craving something that, you know, the mind might not want to.
I was so glad to see somebody approach that as a film. It's about pica. Which you get when you're pregnant, and they always warn you about it when you're pregnant. Like, you're sitting in the doctor's office when they first find you're pregnant, and I remember the doctor being like, if you start getting the urge to drink laundry detergent, tell me. And suddenly I'm like, wait, is that a fucking thing? Wait, back up to the laundry detergent part, but it's a thing apparently that happens to some people when they're pregnant. And I was, because that was such like a weird moment for me hearing that. I was so excited to see that somebody was able to pursue that as a film. It's just about perfect.
Yeah, it's about a woman who starts craving swallowing anything in the house, and especially sharp or cold objects and metal. And it's, you know, knowing somebody's newly pregnant and watching them swallow these things is pretty horrific. But you're definitely, you spend the whole movie almost trying to understand her. And I think that's a really interesting, empathetic look at it. It was a really great performance, too.
Yeah. And then Synchronic with our friends Aaron and Justin, who have been on the show, and Lawson, of course, who's joined us a couple of times at Chattanooga. And so you saw that one last night.
Yeah,
right?
I like all their work, but this felt like a big leap in terms of scale and where I can see this playing in all multiplexes. And it feels like a big science fiction movie. Really great idea. Great concept. And time travel, I'm a total sucker. Who doesn't love time travel? Yeah. It's the greatest. Okay, well, body horror.
Body horror.
What I wanted to start with was asking, when you're even aware, not so much of the movie side of it, but for me, the first memory of I have in cinema where I didn't understand, and I've told you this before, I think I was about 9, and Carrie was playing on TV, and the opening sequence, she's having a period, her period. I think it's for the first time because she doesn't understand it. And her fear of what's happening to her and just seeing blood, visceral blood on the screen running down a drain, literally scared me more than probably anything I had to, because I didn't understand it. I had no concept of what was happening to her. And then to be humiliated by these other girls in that opening scene, even though I'm a different gender, it didn't matter. I was experiencing it the same way she was. So, of course, that's not that's nothing abnormal that's happening to her. But yet, in that moment, it's his body horror. So I was just curious for you, because we were joking about it, but where you're just saying about pregnant cravings under pregnancy is. I've gone to the hospital very little. My body hasn't had to. We're talking about like all you have to go through as a woman in general, whether you have children or not. There's just so much of examinations, and there's so many more things going on that I imagine you have a very different perspective than me on body horror.
Did you seriously just ask me an as a fucking woman question?
I don't think
you
so.
You did.
I think it's a pretty fair one because I can't possibly know the answer to it. So I think it's the opposite of mansplaining, to be honest.
No. I mean, like, childbirth was definitely the most Cronenbergian thing I will probably ever go through, I hope. So yeah, that shit's weird, man. You can actually see the child, like, writhing in your body. Like, I remember sitting on the couch and just seeing things press out, and it's so goddamn weird. But I mean, like, body horror.
But just being young, like when you're young, was the first time you understood the difference of the body.
Ticks. Because of the area that I grew up in, I grew up in Appalachia, and we have a prolific amount of ticks. Like, most of my family has Lyme disease. And most of the community has Lyme disease. But ticks, especially deer ticks, they're the bigger ones, are a thing. And I remember getting those on my body when I was a kid and being both horrified and fascinated by them. And I think I've told the story on the show before about leeches, because we also have leeches. Why the fuck do we live there? But yeah, we also have leeches. And I remember one time swimming and getting out, and there was one stuck to my kind of like side hip. And I remember pulling my shirt down over it because I didn't want anybody to see, because I wanted to look at it for a little bit. And I probably let it stay there for a half an hour watching it before I told my dad. And I couldn't do that now. Like, now that I understand leeches and everything, I don't think they carry diseases, but I think I'd have an anxiety attack with, like, get the fuck off me type moment. But as a kid, I remember being really fascinated with it and having the patience to sit there and watch it. So yeah, and then childbirth happened, and that was just nuts. But body horror on screen, I saw Hellraiser way too young. Like I told, and Demons too. Like there was a lot of horror films. My parents never really censored what I watched in any capacity. I might get the, you realize this is fake, as like my dad was passing very casually through the living room, but that was like the best parenting I got. So I saw a lot of body horror way too young. Brood, I saw ridiculously young.
The Fly. Most horror has, it's, I mean, in terms of talking about it, it's like the sight of the body in horror films is pretty much almost every horror film will have an element of body horror or some sort of carnage to or destruction to the body itself. But these films that focus squarely on it are a different type of movie. And I think I don't want to say they're not meant to be as enjoyable, but I don't think the intent is often to entertain in the same way. I think often it's to make you feel some sort of discomfort because it's something we don't really want to, we don't necessarily naturally want to see. It's like the attraction of repulsion, or revulsion in a sense.
And as I was thinking about these, I realized that a lot of the things that I consider to be like kinder trauma, like shit that I saw way too early, or even children's programming that kind of fucked me up, borderlined on body horror, like Return to Oz, how she kept taking off her head, and the Wheelers, the whole kind of disfigurement of it, and even like Care Bears 2, which for anybody who's seen Care Bears 2, it's got this weird like being sucked into a book stuff going on, and his face changes, and things like that. It tends to rely more on kind of a body horror element to it. It's not exactly like maggots crawling out of your skin. We'll get there later. But
right. There's so many. Like for me as a kid, I my favorite film was The Shining, and I saw it at 8. And to this day, I can, you know, I really think there's no cleverer and more get under your skin scene than the woman in the bathtub, because, you know, this woman who literally walks towards him with all the, and I was too young to have sexual feelings, but I was still drawn to it as this woman's walking towards you and she's beautiful and naked and then draws him in and then suddenly becomes this hag-like creature. And it's like just that shift, which is a very natural human shift of age, just being condensed.
Yeah, I was going to say, that happens.
Right, that's condensed, but it was really disturbing to me. And I think, which pulls up this first quote that we pulled up of Cronenberg, which is just about aging and our bodies. On the PowerPoint we've all got the disease of being finite. Death is the basis of all horror. So just our bodies are, you know, constantly breaking down and fading as we're going through life.
Yeah, even just as I've gotten older, the fact that, like, my knees don't do what they used to, and I don't remember having that wrinkle yesterday, and, yeah, again, childbirth. So, yeah, kind of being confronted. That seems to be the basis of a lot of horror, this idea that our bodies are all breaking down in one way or another, even just while we're sitting here. But we're all scared shitless of it and of it being progressed in any form. So
yeah. And I know, I mean, so what we wanted to do with this convo is, like, have some fun with our picks. We're going to both pick five films that we want to kind of discuss that deal with body horror. But up top, we wanted to just briefly talk about Cronenberg so he wouldn't be our picks, because otherwise we'd both pick five Cronenberg films because he's the central figure.
Yeah,
in
we figured when we were looking at this, we were immediately like, oh, we're just going to pick five Cronenberg films and it's just going to be a Cronenberg list. And what's the fun in that? So we made a no Cronenberg rule in our actual list because we wanted to go more deep cuts. So we're talking about him up top. So
ever since he became a podcaster, I can't respect him. So in terms of Cronenberg, I mean, like, Cronenberg is somebody, like, I can't think of many filmmakers I had this reaction to, but there's certain films of his where I was just talking about Revulsion, is there, Naked Lunch and Crash were both movies that when I saw, and Dead Ringers, that when I saw them, I hated them. Not just hated, couldn't even take it, didn't want to look at the imagery. I wanted to run away from it. It was because those are all three pretty adult.
Crash
sexual.
Is hard to get through. I saw that as a teenager, and there was just something that I didn't like about it. And it wasn't until later that I really found appreciation for it.
Yeah, you see the kink in it later. But Dead Ringers, I mean, I saw it like 10, and I don't think you're meant to think that way.
I don't think I would have understood
it's like on TV in New Zealand. But there's something about it that later on I would think about it and come back to it and have a totally different viewpoint on his films. And I think it's because to him it was really important to show. So I think the reason why I think he's credited for body horror is not that it wasn't happening before, because it's been, body horror has existed since Frankenstein. I think the difference is most movies purposely don't go all the way or show you everything. They cut away for effects reasons and good taste in quote marks.
Like we were talking about that, like Eyes Without a Face.
Yeah,
I was tempted to put on
my
list, but then I was like, is it technically a body horror? Because you know everything that's going on, but you only see it briefly.
Yeah.
It's not.
Well, there is that one, there's one scene where they surgically remove a face and it is terrible. No, I think it would be totally valid, but I think where he pushed is, and I have read quotes about this where he just talks about, I need to show it. That's the difference. You need to see it all. You need to see the part that no one else will show. Otherwise, what was the point of making this film? To him, it was important. And I'm sure it's credited to him, but I remember him saying a long time ago, I remember reading a quote saying that he thought if there was ever a beauty pageant, it should be the insides of our bodies that are judged.
Tales from the Crypt episode.
Oh, really? Yeah.
But
it's such an interesting idea because, you know, it ultimately is the thing that's going to keep us functioning. But no one ever cares about that. So to look inside, I think, was something that he brought to movies that is very different. And do you have one from the start that was the earliest of his films you saw?
I definitely saw Videodrome really young. And I remember it was one of those where I saw the box cover and was like, hey, Mom, can I rent this? And she was like, yeah, whatevs. And I saw it way too young to understand what basic cable was, what community access was, what sex was, what being sucked into a TV, why the typewriter's a vagina. I got none of that. But at the same time, it was captivating to the point that I could not look away. I remember seeing Dead Ringers, and that was one of the first ones that I remember kind of comprehending that these guys were nuts and were hurting people. And by that time I understood, like, basic gynecological tools. The Fly I saw pretty young as well, and that one didn't read as a love story for me until I was much older. It was just a dude who fucked his shit up with a fly.
And that's probably most people's entry point into Cronenberg and into body horror. I mean, in terms of, talk about going all the way. You know, I mean, it is an amazing, if you haven't seen it in a long time, it's an amazing love story. Like, their connection is so great.
It's so sweet, which is weird to say because there's a penis in the medicine cabinet.
Yeah.
But it's so sweet.
Yeah.
Like, I wish I loved someone enough to stick with them through that.
It's fair. but the way he breaks down and kind of the sadness of that ending, it's a film that goes, you see the absolute from start to end deterioration of a body and transformation into something different. Whereas most of those films have an element in Videodrome. You have the slit, the VHS slit in his chest. We're seeing at the bottom The Brood, which is, I think, maybe my favorite of his movies now.
I think so as well.
It's really
I think it's very adult. But yeah, it's very kind of adult and psychological because the majority of the movie is just about a hard divorce.
Yeah.
And then you kind of get this end result of it. But yeah, that's...
Well, he's external. So in that film, the idea is that they're using this drug to basically externalize the pain that the person's going through, and it becomes externalized as a womb that then breeds these little children who are like these little anger babies who are going out and, you know,
in committing revenge. In matching snowsuits.
Yeah, so it's such an interesting idea. But I know you're an Existenz fan. And
I love Existenz.
What is it? Talk us through that one, because that's got the goopy ports.
So yeah, that one's really goopy. And that one is one that does not get a lot of love because it's essentially like a lot of people consider it his lesser Videodrome. Like Videodrome was awesome, and then he made Existenz, and it's basically the same otherworldly concept. But I started really appreciating it a couple of years ago. I was teaching a culture in horror class, and I showed Videodrome and Existenz back to back to show emerging technologies and how we make statements on emerging technologies, because there's literally like 20-year separation on the two. Almost, but yeah, so I'd showed them back to back in a class, and my students, who were all 18 to 20, thought that Videodrome was really dry and boring and made no sense, but they all really connected with Existenz. And it was definitely like a different generational thing. And since then, as I've continued teaching horror theory and horror history, I've stopped showing Videodrome to my students, and I'm still showing Existenz. So now, after years of showing it, I've really gained a lot of appreciation for that movie and what it's doing. Even so much that the title is the Hungarian word for God, which kind of tells you everything going in. It's about Allegra Geller, who is a video game designer. And video games have advanced to the point where you plug them into your back and it's an experience. And I remember even asking my students when I taught it this semester, like, do you ever think we will reach a point where reality and a game that you're playing become indistinguishable? And they're still of the, no, we'll never get there mindset. And I don't agree with that. Like, I think we will keep trying to push reality as far as we can. That's just kind of our nature is, you know, what can we do to recreate things? I'm either going to print an organ or I'm going to, you know, push it entertainment wise. And yeah, it's just going to keep going. But in it, it's incredibly goopy. The video game systems literally look like vaginas.
They're actually biological. They're made
out of creatures. Yeah. And they're connected with these umbilical ports, which they actually, I think, call an umbilical in it. Mm. And it's real goopy and weird. And there's all these little mutant creatures running around. And
it feels a little ahead of its time. When it came out, I think it makes... I thought it was a lot better when I watched it, I think, last year at Beyond Fest or the year before than when I saw it in theaters. It just felt like it was of this time period better.
When it came out in 1999, it definitely didn't fit in with a lot of the other stuff that was coming out. Because you figure, like, 99, we were still coming off what I'll call the giant 90s of, like, The Relic and The Mimic and Deep Rising. And if at the end a monster isn't eating something massive, it wasn't the 90s.
And teen slashers.
The neo slashers. And so then you get this weird little rather small scale wise commentary on video games, which weren't even at that point yet. Like, we were just in 1999. I mean, I was still playing like GoldenEye, shooter type games. We would not advance to the point of virtual reality being something that most of us have at home like we do now with things
like Oculus.
I'm
not even sure if that's what it is. I wonder if it's come closer to the realities we've constructed with our phones, the bubble we've created in our own world every night, where it's just us and our friends and our world and our points of view and our, you know, feedback that we create. It seems almost closer than gaming to what he was, not saying intentionally, but that reality.
It's this whole creation of a character.
Yeah.
The idea that I am creating something completely different than what I actually am.
You're an avatar.
What we, when I was doing marketing, they used to call the sock puppet. Like, you have a sock puppet that you hold up when you go online that becomes you. And so, yeah.
And they all have, quite a few of them have like a VD, sexually transmitted disease type concept. So even this one does with the dirty ports. But I think Shivers, for me, is still one of my favorites of all his films. And it's his first one. And that's, again, it's a sexually transmitted parasite, but again, made... I guess
they
six.
Look really happy to have it.
Yeah,
that
pool scene looks actually pretty fun.
They look really happy.
But that's like 5 or 6 years before AIDS would become like a epidemic that people mm-hmm. were talking about, and it's just so close.
And I love it because it's infecting the rich. This is not, a lot of times when you see disease portrayed in horror, it's something that, you know, it becomes like pandemic where it's affecting the lower class people who can't afford to lock themselves up. And I love that one because it is in this like super wealthy tower.
Yeah.
This like
a designer drug.
Yeah, designer druggy type stuff.
Panos Cosmatos said, who made Mandy, said something really interesting about Videodrome, which might be the most accurate thing that's ever hit me with a rescreening, is I loved Videodrome when I saw it on VHS and just think it's one of the great films. And then a couple years ago, I saw it at Beyond Fest on a big screen, and it almost did nothing for me, and I felt really weird. I felt bad.
Really?
Like, I, as a cinephile, I sat there going, why is this movie not having the power
that it had? Was that when we were at Beyond Fest?
Yeah, it could have been at Beyond Fest, when we were at Beyond Fest. But yeah. I felt just totally different. And then I heard Panos on a podcast, and he said that film should never be screened on film. And he's like, that film is meant to be seen on VHS and on TVs because of what it's about. And as soon as it's put on 35, he's like, it loses something, which is funny because obviously it started on 35. But it was exactly my experience of that film, which is strange because it is such a clever and interesting movie. But something about the personal, you know, I'm a big screen lover. I love the big screen. But there's something about that film that feels so intimate and weird, like you're meant to have stumbled upon cable access alone with it, you know.
No, that one, I remember watching it on my parents' like weighs a bajillion tons console TV. They had like one of those big wooden giant console TVs with a tethered remote with the VCR, which we put on top. And then one of the VCRs broke. And then you put another VCR right on top of it. And so we had that. And then that way, when you got the second VCR fixed, you could do dirty edits, which is how I learned to make films with my parents' camcorder. But yeah, I remember watching it on that. And so it looks just like the TV that he is seeing in there. And it even had like the curved screen and everything. Yeah, it's definitely a media movie. But I still love the messages that Videodrome was putting forth, because even if the technology that it's doing it on feels dated, the whole idea of Brian Oblivion, that he has died, but we are keeping him alive. You know, I was talking about this on the technology portion of Nightmare University, how technology keeps us alive now, and there's nothing that reminds me more of this than I had made a couple of projects with Guar, including a Guar video, and so I got to know Dave Brocky really well, and it was crushing when he passed away, but every couple of months, a post from his Facebook page will pop up on my feed, and it's the weirdest thing, and it's his birthday announcements or five-year friendiversary and things like that, and it is so warming and kind of out of body simultaneous to see that pop up, because you're like, oh, wait. And it just sets you back for a sec. But that said, like, it's living on. And every single time those pop up, I click on his page again and look through the pictures and suddenly remember Dave. So it's this weird moment of kind of living on through social media and living on through media in general. And then I look at things, which even this is dated now, but like Tupac Cello. It's exactly what they were talking about in Videodrome, the idea that we can preserve image and thus you will live on even if you are separated
from
us.
Or the idea that we're going to put actors, like James Dean's going to be in another movie and you have to go, well, but that's against his consent. And you might have his likeness and his image, but the thing that made you compelled to watch James Dean on a screen was a flicker behind the eyes that is unimaginable to a computer. And the thing that made an actor important and have that X factor that not everyone has on this planet is something that can never be recreated. And so it's really against just the kind of, it just feels dark and strange to be dredging up corpses like this to me. I think there's also just something inherently, it's a fail to me.
You don't think there's something beautiful about living forever through technology?
I don't. I think there's an organic nature to things. I mean, I think that's where Cronenberg's work's certainly interesting, because I think he's fascinated where technology is going to intersect with the body itself. And I think some of the movies we'll pick will kind of touch on that. But no, I mean, it's, you know, I don't, I think life, knowing that life is finite, like this original quote, I think can shape how we live our lives. And if I think, oh, it's just going to go on forever, it's going to make things less sweet and less special. And so I think there is something important about living that way. And I think if we get to a point of, like, look, so Dark Mirror, which I'm a big fan of. Oh, no, Black Mirror, sorry. Black Mirror, the episode San Junipero.
This is the most beautiful moment of television ever in the past 20 years.
Right, but that's a great episode to have. I won't spoil it here, but have a conversation with somebody after it ends. It's this very beautiful time travel kind of piece about love, and it ends with the kind of sci-fi element of the last thing you see. That could be beautiful to someone, or it could be kind of horrific in a sense. And, you know, see where you fall on that idea.
I don't know. I think we do it already. If we're not preserving somebody's Facebook page, we do it through pictures. We do it through the last voicemail that your grandmother left you. I think that we do it already without even realizing it, and we're just pushing it to the next level.
I also think, like, our feelings are becoming, like... I don't want to get too high heady, but I think it's
poetry. Yeah, this is getting heady.
No, but that idea of, like, you take a picture of a, you know, famous painting in the Louvre, and then you take a reprint of it and a reprint. And eventually, all I'm doing is looking at a reprint of that, and what is my feeling towards that compared to when somebody, the example you're giving with death on the internet, it's unless that person was physically in your life and you saw them and were close, it becomes, oh, that's really sad. And then you forget, it gets cycled out with other news and things keep moving. And I don't think we get to feel the depth of that in the same way. And same with likes and everything. So I know this is off topic because we're talking about
body, like,
the tech side of this. Yeah. But I do think the two things for our futures are going to be entwined.
No, and that seems to be where we have seen a lot of body horror as of late, is it's not necessarily just straight mutation. It's not exactly just Kafka's Metamorphosis anymore. We tend to link, computer's going to sleep, we tend to link technology and the body together, and that seems to be, even going back to the body parts stuff in the 90s, where a lot of our contemporary body horror kind of roots itself, is this idea of... new organs, technology, things like that.
Yeah. So,
and I don't think that's changing in any capacity.
Do you have any, like, things, before we get to our picks, do you have anything in the body horror or things that you see in movies that just you can't do? Like, it's just too much for you?
Teeth. Hmm. And that's a weird one. But teeth in general, anytime teeth fall out or get cracked, which is crazy because we were in, I did cry. We were at Phoenix Comic Con, Phoenix Fan Fest last year, and I cracked a tooth on a corner of popcorn and literally half broke off. And so I was literally standing there. Elric was like, what's going on? And I'm holding half my tooth and blood coming out of my mouth. And I started crying. I remember that.
And then
that.
She pulled some Rambo shit and I'm driving the car and she's fixing her tooth with the surgical gear.
It was like hurting so bad. I got like this putty that you can actually buy at like CVS to like seal your tooth until you can get to a dentist because it was like Memorial Day weekend or something. And so yeah, he was driving and I was literally like putting putty on my tooth. But no, that for me.
And she still had that leech on her body. She was just like, I just want to look at it a little longer as she bleeds out.
I got the tooth fixed the next day. But teeth in general, that's something that I'm always kind of like, I can handle organs for some reason, probably because I don't think I've seen them in excess in real life. But teeth thing, that's something that like I have experienced. I have broken teeth before, and that when it does happen in body horror, I'm always like, oh, okay, well, you know, your eyeballs blew up, but that was cool. But as soon as that tooth fell out, man, I'm done.
Yeah.
So yeah, what's yours?
I think mine, I had a kidney stone for the first time, and what freaked me out, because I'd never really had much experience with hospitals, what freaked me out is that it's not associated with that part of your body. So when the initial pain hits, it's like you think you're thrown out your back or something. So I think it's these phantom pain movies, anything about something that can't be located like surgically. So when the person's suffering or metamorphosizing, I always find that to be quite frightening now because of having gone through something where you have no idea what's happening to you. And yet when you find out that it's this tiny little thing that is like causing you to, I mean, I remember one nurse coming in. No. And this is the fun part. One nurse came in, I remember, and she just looked at me and she goes, oh, so much worse than childbirth, and walked out.
She was
out.
Probably trying to make you feel better.
Maybe. But it was, you know, it didn't. It was
I love Stacey's in the front and she's like,
She can't quantify that. But also I think what's interesting in movies, I think the way the frame and the screen can amplify small details. One of my favorite things to watch is when people get their fingernails
peeled
back.
Have you ever had that happen?
I've done it little bites. But what I mean by that is like that is when the audience reacts. It is the nail that goes into the arm in Hellraiser when they're moving the bed. Everyone feels that more than the rest of the movie. So these are... it's those little close-up details where somebody goes, oh, I could imagine stepping on that nail. I can imagine that pin.
And
I can imagine
breaking
those
are the things that we've been through. Like, I think I relate to nails more because there was one time when I was unloading the dishwasher and I stuck a fork tine underneath one of my fingernails as I was grabbing the cutlery. And I think that a lot of people have probably done that at some point or something similar to it. And so fingernails and teeth I find more relatable because those are things that we encounter in our normal everyday life. My spleen exploding and having tentacles come out, I got no fucking clue.
Yeah.
But I'm sure if I had, I would suddenly be like, oh, I feel that spleen gag.
If anyone will have that happen, you're the lady.
Wait for the plane ride home.
Emerge. All right, so let's get into our movies. Did you, like, I went, I didn't go as much Carnage the Body. So with body horror, there's lots of types of horror. There's the horror being done to the body. There's surgical types of horror. Mm-hmm. There is horror that's coming from inside the body and changing the person. Did you have a trend that you saw come through?
No, I tried to mix them because there are certain subgenres that lend themselves to body horror that I really like. So I kind of tried to pick one from each of the subgenres that I kind of felt so that I wasn't doing like a whole bunch of Japanese movies. Because they definitely love body horror. And I wasn't doing a whole bunch of like aquatic mutation movies and things like that. So I tried to mix.
So your number five is?
Yes, Tokyo Gore Police. Speaking of Japanese. So I love, I don't even know if these movies have like their own title in Japan. I've always called them Japanese techno gore. But I know some of them fall under the Sushi Typhoon label. But it's just this wonderful little enclave of movies that came out kind of back to back in the 2000s, where we had Meatball Machine, which is one of my faves. It's a lot lower budget. It's a lot kind of wackier. There's a lot of stuff in that that I will call sophomoric and tasteless, but I find really amusing in it. Meatball Machine, and then Tokyo Gore Police, Machine Girl, Robo Geisha's in there. And there's just a whole Frankenstein Girl. There's a whole bunch of them back to back, and I love them all. But Tokyo Gore Police is my favorite. This is the actress from Audition. Doing crazy stuff far from audition in this one. And the whole setup is that we have this kind of mutative virus is sweeping society. This virus is sweeping society. And when your body gets injured in any capacity, it mutates. And so once you're infected with this thing, you can cut your arm off, and instead of just having no arm, you will suddenly grow this kind of weapon or a claw or something crazy. And people have learned to design their bodies because of that. They call them engineers in the movie, where they are literally kind of designing their bodies. Some do it for pleasure. Some do it more for like a fashionable sense. And then some people do it so they can fuck your shit up. And then there's this group of police who are there to kind of control the mutations that are taking place. And it just gets absolutely bonkers. But I love this movie because it's not just bonkers for the sake of bonkers. There's so much style in it. There's this absolutely beautiful shot that I still show in my film aesthetics class when I'm teaching cinematography, where she has cut the arms off of this guy and blood is raining all over. And as she's walking away, it's this incredibly deep focus shot with this blood rain just coming down on her as she walks away in slow motion. And it's breathtaking. Just absolutely gorgeous. So I love this because it is this mix of like super intense body horror, lowbrow humor, but at the same time, it's got this biting social commentary that goes along with it about, you know, kind of body modification and cutting and how far you're willing to push it. And then it's just got crazy amounts of gore and bloodshed. It's kind of Troma-esque in its bloodshed, which I find hilarious.
I haven't seen, but I like that it sounds like they're empowered by the body horror.
It is. It's definitely like an empowerment thing. Even so much so that at the end she has kind of a if you can't beat them, join them attitude where she has to start modifying her body to try to beat the bad guys. So yeah,
all right.
It's a trip.
So full on body gore. And that's the other thing we didn't really talk about, but probably the biggest shift to this subgenre and why it probably coincides with the late 70s and 80s is the rise of practical special effects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the things you could do and the kind of guys who were doing them. As we get to the top of this list, you'll see a couple names that where it's just utterly bonkers.
Yeah.
I know we didn't, neither of us put the thing on this because it's almost too obvious, but the thing is obviously you're just seeing the greatest carnage and transformations to ever happen to bodies.
Totally.
Horror fans, nabnew.com is your new destination for keeping up with the latest horror collectibles. At launch, NAB is aggregating 27 of the top online stores into one place so you can find the new releases of DVDs, toys, figures, comics, vinyl soundtracks, board games, and more. Simply follow your favorite horror properties and you'll get a custom feed with all the day's new releases that matter to you. And since we have everything in one place, you can easily compare prices across vendors, check stock availability, and nab it before it's gone. So NAB is more than just horror. You can follow everything from American Psycho to My Hero Academia. So we put together a special collection for Shockwaves fans. Visit nabnew.com/horror to check it out. That's nabnew, nabnew.com/horror. It's 2020 and Fangoria magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use the promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now. Tonight's episode is also brought to you by our friends at Vinegar Syndrome, and it's their wildest month of releases yet. The jaw-dropping early 80s Canadian Gore Fest Deadline makes its worldwide Blu-ray debut. Exploitation auteur Uli Lommel's bizarre mix of erotic thriller and slasher Olivia finally comes to Blu-ray in its actual uncut version, featuring bloodshed and nudity unseen in for over 35 years. And lastly, Andrea Biacci's brain-busting X-rated take on The Exorcist, Malabimba, makes its uncut disc debut in a must-have Blu-ray. So what are you waiting for? Head over to VinegarSyndrome.com and get your orders in today. And while you're at it, be sure to sign up for their mailing list so you never miss another announcement or exclusive sale again. This week, Fright Rags has released 5 new long-sleeve shirts for popular titles such as Halloween, The Blair Witch Project, and more. Featuring all new artwork and detailed sleeve prints, there is no better way to wear your love of horror on your sleeve. And also available this week, the all-time favorite Kill Destroyers design is back. Originally designed by Jason Edmondson back in 2013, it is now back for a limited time as a regular shirt or a tour-style baseball tee. Grab it while you can, all exclusively at fright-rags.com. And listeners, you can get 10% off your first order with the code WAVES10. That's WAVES10.
What I pick? Okay. So this is one people don't think of as a body horror, and it might be the ultimate body horror film. And it's the only one that this of the Nightmare on Elm Street films that classify as this, which is A Nightmare on Elm Street 2. It's the last time I saw it, actually watching it again was great because it was the film I didn't particularly like in the series when I was young. And watching it again, it's a scary, disturbing movie. It might be the darkest of the films. And you see somebody grappling with something really real. And I think in this, whether the filmmakers knew it or not, right, they're making a film that seemed to be about coming out. And it seemed to be, they show it with Freddy literally emerging from the body itself of the main protagonist. And it is so painful. And in this case, they're showing it as this dark other, right? This terribly dark other because it's Freddy. But if the pain and also what the performance that the actor is going through seem to, especially now with the knowledge we know that he was going through a lot of pain. I haven't seen the documentary on this yet, but it's a really dark one. And again, the practical effects of Freddy physically cutting himself out of another person's body to emerge is like nothing they ever really did in this Nightmare saga. And so for me, it's one that I've never really even heard it in the conversation of body horror. But I think this is deserved. I mean, this kind of thing I'd love to read somebody write a really great essay on because I think it's kind of exactly what I want to think body horror is because it does feel like there's a satirical or point to open up a conversation about something real.
Yeah, and the later entries into the franchise definitely have body horror elements. You know, she's turning into a cockroach.
Yeah,
she's
yeah.
turning into a motorcycle.
That's fun.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is some body horror elements, but they're always much more as a comedy thing.
Yeah.
Of, oh, she's turning into a cockroach. This does not feel comedic in any capacity. Like, the transformations are brutal.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it, the movie always has kind of a kitsch feel to it, right. But these transformations are intense.
Yeah, which makes it almost more disturbing. But I know, does anyone know the name of the documentary that's coming out? Scream Queen. Just Scream Queen. Coming out this year, I believe, right? It's been on the festival circuit a bit. So I'm very much looking forward to this because, you know, I remember when the large documentary on the whole franchise came out, I remember Jack Shalter being in complete denial that this had anything about being, and you're just watching the movie go, that's impossible. You know, it's truly impossible. But really, if you're like me and you kind of wrote this one off, take a look back at it. I think there's some real power there. Mm-hmm. Number four, Becca?
Is Leviathan. So that's probably my favorite subgenre is aquatic horror. Like I'd say nunsploitation definitely makes its way up there, but aquatic horror is one of my favorites. And Leviathan, a lot of aquatic horror includes some type of transformations. Not all of it. I mean, like Underwater was absolutely amazing and there's no body horror element to it exactly. But a lot of the kind of more isolated horror films function much like Thing, where it's a group of people in this isolated environment and their bodies literally start changing. And Leviathan, I consider to be one of the best of it, where it's a group of I think they may have been down there for science, in the name of science. Usually, if you're underwater, you're there for mining purposes. Like
I think there's
all
some
of
oil
the
rigging stuff happening there too. From memory,
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure there's science, but I'm not sure.
Peter Weller looks like he's there for oil, not science.
He must be there for oil, no. Probably oil. But yeah, we're just going to assume they're scientific miners. But they're there, and they happen upon this sunken ship that is at the bottom of the sea, but it's not supposed to be there. It's supposed to be in the Baltic Sea. And they go on board, and everybody's dead, and they can't find anybody, but they find a bottle of vodka, and Six-Pack starts drinking it, and they discover that there's some type of virus in the vodka, and the ship, the entire crew starts mutating and kind of forming this weird, like, mono creature. And, it's just got amazing transformation stuff. There's a weird lamprey-like creature, but this one for me as a kid, and this goes back to the things that we understand. There's crazy scenes where, like, a lamprey attacks somebody. There's a scene where she literally looks down in her skin and sees these little worm-like things crawling around. But the scene that impacted me the most was she's in the bathroom in the shower, and she starts tugging at her hair, and it starts coming out in chunks. And I remember that finding so much more terrifying than, you know, oh, yeah, and my arm stretching out and forming tentacles like that.
Because it's real, and it actually happens to people.
Yeah, the hair thing, I just remember really being freaked out by. But yeah, Leviathan.
And this one's directed by George P. Cosmatos, who's the father of Panos, who directed Mandy. If anyone doesn't know, that's fun. My number four is a lesser-known French film. I used to run a film club when I was in film school, and this is the only film that I'd say half the people walked out. Because it really is probably it is not an easy film to watch but I think this is the part of body horror where it's the internal, and this actually has a lot in common with the movie Swallow, but this one pushes it in a more visceral way. So this is a French film, an actress who was a co-writer on a couple of Francois Ozon films and then made her own film, Marina Devan. And this film, she basically she's kind of a high corporate raider type. She's really trying to move up the ladder in her work, and she goes to a party and gets cut outside, like something cuts her leg really badly, and she tries to hide it from everyone. She goes up in the bathroom and there's just blood everywhere. She's putting a towel on it, and then she becomes increasingly obsessed by the cut, and she can't stop looking at it and touching it and provoking it, and then she starts to cut herself in other ways and can't stop, and she doesn't know what it is, and she keeps rising up this corporate ladder. That's an element I'm not exactly sure about French culture in it, but it culminates in this one scene where you can see a still with the severed arm, where she goes to dinner with her bosses, and at some point she looks down at the dinner table and her arm is not connected to her body, and it's just perfectly sitting there, and she has this urge to almost want to cut it and maybe even taste it. It's this feeling she has of disconnection with her body, and that really becomes the psychological layer of body horror films, which I find, you know, equally fascinating. And this film, by the end, she really literally turned. It's kind of like Raw as well, to an extent, but much more disturbing than Raw, I think, because it's all about turning on your own body and seeing it as other, and then being able to destroy it because it's not part of you. but having that fascination. And it is a very intense movie. And if you haven't seen it, if you can take that, I highly recommend it, because it's also, I think, a very personal film. I can see the filmmaker laying bare something, whether it's exactly the story you're seeing in terms of what she might have gone through. But I think it just feels personal and intense because of that.
I always love this one. This is one of the movies that I remember squirming in. Yeah. Like, there's definitely a handful of movies that I have these, like, oh, that messed me up when I was seeing it. And this is one of them where I was thinking about it for days afterwards. But at the same time, I think it goes back to kind of one thing, unlike Swallow, a compulsion that I think a lot of us have without even realizing it, which is being both simultaneously horrified and fascinated by our own bodies, whether you're doing something as simple as like picking a zit,
yeah,
or looking at that like crazy scabbed up thing on your knee with like fascination, and this kind of amusement of how gross our bodies are at the same time as beautiful,
yeah,
and being horrified by wounds, but also enamored by them. It's the reason that we all watch the medical channel and stuff like that.
Isn't there an actual pimple popping Dr. Pimple Popper show?
Yeah, I watched one episode of
that
and was like, I can't do this.
That's
like, that one, I can watch horror movies. If that was in a horror movie, I could do it.
Yeah.
But when it was like a reality show, I was like, oh, this is, I can't do this. This is a bit much. So yeah. But at the same time, it's the same reason that stuff like that is popular. Yeah. It's the simultaneous kind of fascination with body damage of being able to see the inside and what the body is capable, yeah, of, like in this grotesque kind of train wreck way. But yeah, and repulse simultaneously.
And this was from a period of French extremity, which is a really interesting period. It's interesting when these things just suddenly leave, and suddenly we're not really thinking much about French horror films right now. There's been a couple really interesting ones last couple of years, but there was a period where you had a lot of films, and a lot of them were about extreme violence to the body.
Yeah, Martyrs, Calvary was Belgium, Satan, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was an exciting time in those films.
Number three. Street Trash. So Street Trash is incredibly fun, but it's not, because this is one bleak movie.
Yeah.
So Street Trash, it's kind of just a beautiful mess. The whole setup is that it is set in this absolutely economically, I can't even call it depressed, like it's decimated area of, I think it's supposed to be outside New York.
Yeah, this is like old New York.
Yeah,
that
like
exist.
Old,
yeah,
like New York, Jersey area. And it is set in this incredibly economically just devastated area where all
it
of
might
these.
Might be the Bowery, right?
And no, I think it's supposed to be further out than that. Okay. Like it's definitely supposed to be the outskirts. Because like even in the 80s, this didn't look like the Bowery. Like the Bowery had gone a little bit past that. But who knows? It might be the Bowery. But that said, it's incredibly depressed area. And the majority of the people that you meet in the film are homeless and living in a junkyard area. And so it's this kind of like entire population, this entire society that has been born out of living homeless in this junkyard area. And nearby, there is a liquor store that many of them frequent, and they find this bottle of, well, it's like a whole case of like expired booze that no one knows where they came from in the basement. And rather than trash them, they decide to put a buck a piece on them, 10 a fly viper, and sell them. And so the local homeless community starts going nuts for them, but the 10 a fly viper causes them to start melting. And so it's this simultaneous kind of love story, this statement on the complete and total devastation of society economically, how we are looking to exploit our fellow man for a buck, and then seeing kind of the reflections of this, I'll call it a disease, sweeping through. The gore in this is not in any way realistic. It's done by the incredibly skilled Jennifer Aspinall, who had just come off of, she had done Trauma. She had done Toxic Avenger.
Yeah, she did Toxic.
And she did something we talked about recently.
It was a
Blu-ray release, and
yeah,
I can't
just
remember
recently,
it.
Yeah,
so she'd done a couple of films, but she did Street Trash. And interesting choice to make the melting so day glow and vibrant, because it is by far the most beautiful thing in the film. Because the film is set in this incredibly bleak industrial trash heap, to then have these incredible blues and pinks and hypercolors pouring out of the bodies it really is kind of the most refreshing scenes of the movie because everything else is just so bleak and horrible.
And there is a flying penis.
So yeah, but it creates just this weird aesthetic. And this is one of these movies that I always think like, oh yeah, it's fun because I remember all the splatter and the Dago colors. And then I watch it again and I'm like, this is just, it's bleak. It is sad. And even the ending is just, there's no hope. It's just this postmodern of why do we keep trying? This is just where we are and there's no getting out of it.
I remember we had the producer on a very early episode of Killer POV.
Roy Frumkes.
And he had a great story about the reviews they were getting slammed when it first came out. And so they took the good reviews and put it on the left hand of a page and put the terrible reviews on the right. And it just said, which side of the street are you? And I thought that was a great way to advertise this film. And just kind of, they were early adopters of leaning into the negative press because a movie like this couldn't really expect to get positive press. And also the director, Jim Murrow, went on to become pretty much one of the most famous Steadicam operators in Hollywood. He's like, when you watch the new Star Trek movies, he's probably operating that Steadicam. I mean, he became a major, major filmmaker in that way, but not as a director.
Which is something else that makes a weird conflict in this movie, is you are watching this absolute horrible devastation and these absolute horrible set pieces with these people in absolute poverty. But it is shot gorgeously, with this beautiful Steadicam just flying around the trash heap, and then this beautiful love story as kind of your spine that the movie is hung on. But the body horror in it is intense. It's come up a lot for us. For social commentary, 1% horror, things like that. So yeah,
I can't remember my three. Speaking of flying penises, I can do one better than a flying penis. I can give you a giant metallic gonna fuck you up penis in Tetsuo the Iron Man, which I hadn't seen in about 20 years. And the day we were taking this flight, I'd already picked it again. And I decided, I was going to jump on like an elliptical machine, and it's exactly 67 minutes long, this film. And I swear to God, I was probably going to have a heart attack because the movie moves so fast. It wouldn't matter what you're physically doing. This movie is sprinting for 67 minutes of utter bonkers, but it's like experiment. You see a direct lineage to Eraserhead. It almost feels like it could be a sequel because it feels like it's taking place in the place at the start and end of Eraserhead with the weird guy on a planet and pulling a lever. It feels like it's almost set in that aspect of it. It's independently made. It's definitely coming at the height of Japan's Western culture invading Japan. What is the future of tech in Japan? And this is a movie that basically opens with the director is in the film playing a metal fetishist. Have no context for why he gets off on metal, and he literally is cutting himself in the opening scene and shoving a metal rod into his leg. He then gets him so excited he runs down the street and he gets run over by a couple. And then the story shifts to the couple, and the guy has been somehow infected by this, and the couple basically start to become metal, especially the guy first. Parts of his body are being infected until he's becoming a full-on metal kind of warrior thing. At one point, a giant drill comes out of his penis, which initially looks like it arouses her, and then she realizes the implications of that, and it's not so fun. And it really is savage and intense for like another 50 minutes. And then at the last 10 minutes, it becomes a kaiju monster movie where the original metal fetishist wants revenge on them. He's come back to have this crazy big battle with this giant iron warrior. And you're like, this movie is so bonkers. It's Shinya Tsukamoto, who's gone on to make a lot of movies always with the same kind of energy. And I think he's a really great filmmaker, but he was actually in Scorsese's Before the Irishman last movie playing a major role, and he didn't even say who he was. He went into audition for Scorsese not saying he's this famous Japanese director, and no one recognized him except Scorsese. And he walked in the room and Scorsese was just like, how did no one tell me you're this great director? Scorsese's bowing, and I think that just tells you how great cinephile Scorsese is. But this movie, I think, is an essential for when it comes to experimental filmmaking and why the avant-garde and horror are just always going to be linked in such an important way, because if we aren't pushing the edges of what is acceptable, you damn right Hollywood won't. Hollywood is not going to push that on purpose unless you push them, unless you push the edges of what's acceptable, because this is outlaw cinema. These are the people, and whether you like it, that's why sometimes when I don't like something and it goes too far for me, whether it's your Cannibal Holocaust or something like that, I still appreciate that it's finding the edge. It's pushing to what is acceptable or even watchable on a screen, because I don't believe at all in censorship. Yeah. So for me, these kind of movies are so punk in that way. And this is truly, to me, one of the old-timers of that feeling. And Street Trash as well, though. I think they kind of are a pair in that way of those movies that, you know, there's a lot of shit in here you can't necessarily feel great about, but you can't be helped but be carried away with the vision of it.
I remember in college, I worked at a video store, and this is one that I brought home with me one night, and I made my roommates watch, and they both left. And I was like, y'all go ahead and go. I'm watching this. And so they went off to the bar while I sat home and watched Tetsuo, and just completely captivated and mesmerized the entire time. And this was probably one of the films that I would say really impacted me. So yeah. It made me want to make something that batshit crazy. And it is really hard to get batshit crazy funded.
But this you wouldn't have done.
This is
made
definitely
by
like,
self-finance.
Like, I talked in my micro-budget Nightmare University lecture yesterday about you find this idea, this concept as a creationist, and if you do not somehow get it out of your brain, it's going to drive you insane. It's like a shard of glass in your brain. This is clearly somebody's shard of metal in this instance.
The best advice with this kind of stuff, and it's sometimes hard to take yourself, but something I always have to remind myself is you have to go all the way with your idea, right? If you have an idea and you're like, oh, I want to take it this far, but at a certain point, this could be watered down and condensed to something that might just almost become grotesque, but without the attraction part, because he didn't go all the way. And if you go all the way, it's going to find some audience. Somebody is going to understand what you're saying because you completely exposed something about yourself. And this film is wild. Number two.
The Stuff.
Woo! Larry Cohen.
So this doesn't get enough love as a body horror. It gets love for being a horror comedy, but this for me was perfect social commentary of the 1980s. I didn't see it until much, much later. I saw It Lives and things like that really early, but I did not see The Stuff until I was probably in grad school by this time. And just kind of, you know, going off the health craze and the marketing and the commercialization of everything and kind of the glamorous plastic 80s and the alien goo that mutates you but tastes like vanilla.
His films are like, he's so smart because he almost makes his films seem dumb, and yet he's really, really smart.
Silly.
And his satire is, yeah, exactly.
With, like, an amazing smart vein.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing with these kind of tales. But this one he did, even though you would think it's about the health food craze because it's on screen, it is, his inspiration was literally World War II, all the cigarettes being handed out for free to GIs and completely hooking a generation on death. You know, like, it was literally done by the government to hook them. And you're like, that's so funny. And it really upset him. I remember talking to him once, and that was something he never got over, and he wants to stick it to the man and stick it to corporate America.
And the effects in this, well, like, The Stuff looks amazing. We asked him what flavor it was, and he told us it was Häagen-Dazs, right?
Oh, I can't remember.
Yeah, he, like, told us that they used a combination of, like, Häagen-Dazs. There was Cool Whip in some of it.
And then he pitched four movies to us in 5 seconds.
Yes.
The Larry Cohen. I remember saying goodbye at the end of the interview, and even then he goes, and that reminds me of this one pitch about Starbucks and all the Starbucks. I mean, he's just like...
He was amazing.
I like people describe people as forces. I don't think I've ever met a storytelling force quite like Larry Cohen.
What did we interview him for?
It was for Shockwaves. And maybe Sing Before. And he came to Jump Cut and did his... No, Lieberman.
That was a different one.
Yeah, that's Lieberman.
Yeah, no, there was something that we had done, like a... Or I guess it was your the documentary.
Well, there's a documentary on Larry Cohen. If you haven't seen it, it's really just King Cohen. Yeah, it's just a beautiful...
Elric Sennett.
Well, I'm not. I'm in the background. But just because he did a table reading of a script that never got made. And
that
he came,
was it. The Black Crows one. The movie theater one.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. And he came to... He cast it and did it at this little cafe spot I ran. And it was... Just like, I remember looking over at, it doesn't matter now. I looked over at him and, you know, seeing an artist in their later period, you know, and he's passed a couple years ago now, he just looked so happy. Mm-hmm. And he's a guy who, like, kind of holds that in. I remember looking over at one point, he just had this smile because even though he didn't get to make another movie, he got to see his work that never got made with actors delivering. You could see the joy that brought him. And I think when you see that, if this is what you want to do, that it's moments like that kind of bring home. But this is a super fun movie. And you're right, like, you can see Chocolate Chip Charlie in the still, the body damage done to the expansion of the mouth and the face, and then all this white stuff coming from inside the body is pretty
There's
grotesque.
Only a couple moments of body horror in this, but the stuff bursting out from within, it just always makes me happy.
The Stuff's a much catchier title than Pus, which it also looks like it could have been called, which might have failed. This is the weird one. I watched this again a couple nights ago. This is John Frankenheimer's Seconds, and I'd never thought about it as body horror, and it's the least gory and visceral movie on my list, but it is, I think, maybe the best example I've ever seen of what body horror could be, which is psychological. There's a deep psychological impact of body horror. And this is, if you haven't seen this on Amazon Prime right now, free, and it is from the 60s, and it might be, it feels like it was made yesterday. It moves. The style is incredible. All the fisheye lens and close-ups, placing camera on a character's shoulder as they walk around, like stuff that just, to me, took another 20 years to really catch on. But it's basically the first 30 minutes follows this man in his 60s who's in a, you know, not a bad marriage. He's just reached an impasse where he doesn't feel as much. And he is followed by a man going to work who keeps kind of giving him these little clues. And you watch this character for a good 30 minutes. So he becomes basically the star of your movie as you realize he's a banker and he just seems like a very boring character. And he's getting this message from an old friend of his that he believes died years ago. And he's hearing the guy's voice. It doesn't sound the same on the phone. And the guy says, you're going to meet at this place and you're going to go do this thing. And he doesn't know what it is. And he shows up to this lab and basically, they kind of force him to go do this procedure, but they're making it sound like it's going to be great, where you're going to get to leave your life. You're going to have to, there's a corpse that's going to be left in your wake. Your family's going to think you died. And when you come out, you're going to look 30 years younger and get to live a life that they're going to set you up in. They're going to pay for it. And it all sounds too good to be true. And guess what? He comes out as Rock Hudson, who I think this is the last time where Rock Hudson just looks dynamite. He's like, you know, incredible looking. He's a great actor, an actor I think whose personal life has overshadowed what he was as an actor. He's an incredible actor. And this is the film where, again, it's funny, I didn't think about this, but just like Nightmare, where you have a character struggling with their persona of being not being able to be out, in Rock Hudson's case, where he was in Hollywood, he was forced to be, you know, in the closet, but was, you know, and Hollywood had a lot of major relationships with men. This film, you feel that struggle of who you are. So basically, he now looks like Rock Hudson, and there's a great scene where this attractive woman looks at him, and he double takes because he has no idea why she's looking at him because he's not used to being looked at because it's been 30 years since anyone's probably even seen him in that way. And he really struggles with this transformation to the point where he has an utter breakdown. I'm not going to go further with the plot because I'd love you guys to see this one, where it goes. It has some good twists, kind of like The Game with Michael Douglas, which I'm a big fan of, but this is much more about the body. And if you haven't seen it, it's really, I'd put this as one of the top thrillers of all time, more than horror, but also just, you know, just to see Rock Hudson. And also, you know, it's another movie that definitely took an element from it in the last couple of years is Get Out, for sure, but in it, just taking that one element of trying to live inside a different body, mm-hmm. and how that is a really difficult thing, because when you look at yourself, you no longer see what you believe is yourself. And I think that's a very disturbing idea. So that's Seconds.
Yeah.
Number one.
Woo. Altered States for me.
Yeah, bonkers.
So I love this movie so much. I love everything the director does. But this one in particular is about a student scientist who is trying to explore the furthest reaches of the mind. And so he's taking a lot of drugs and locking himself in this deprivation chamber in an attempt to try to push himself into a different realm. And then he actually starts kind of changing into something else that is kind of like altered him from this other realm. And I just love it because it's...
Well, from the past.
Yeah, it's like it gets prehistoric even.
Yeah.
So it's just got so much wonderful body horror. He has these just deliciously surreal dreams when he goes into the other realms. Very religious because that's what the director does. So yeah,
you got Dick Smith doing the effects, which, you know, Dick Smith's the best. And a very young 18-year-old or maybe even 17-year-old intern, Rob Bottin. And so when you see some of the flesh moving under it, you're like, oh, yeah, I see.
That
definitely. But no, this one, because I hadn't seen this in 20 years either and just watched it for a sci-fi episode of my other podcast. And it blew me away how, like, just visceral and kind of messed up this movie is. You know, he's basically going back in time, essentially, and bringing back whatever the elements of that time
were
in his body.
Prehistoric moments.
Yeah, very disturbing.
It's real trippy. So if you have not seen Altered States, this is not a well-known horror film today, but I highly recommend checking it out.
Ken Russell. And any fans of the Fringe TV show here, the lead actress from this would go on to be the head of the labs in the Fringe show, mm-hmm. which I thought was a cool connection. My number one is Extro. in terms of body, like anytime we can turn someone on to Extra, we're going to take that opportunity.
I remember when you first watched this.
I know. Look, we have a listener in the UK, Dennis Atherton, who's like the number one fan of this movie, the way I feel about Possession, I guess. And he's actually on their DVD and everything. So I'm so happy that he gets to be part of this film. But this film, in terms of just what you see the body go through, is pretty stunning. Otherwise, you could see it as, you know, a cheap Alien ripoff, but it does some stuff that is just utterly bonkers. It's a family movie, perfect for the whole family. A father goes missing, is abducted by aliens at the start, and he comes back a couple years later, and this alien creature is on the side of the road that you can see in the bottom there. It's pretty grotesque.
It walks backwards.
At one point, it goes into a farmhouse, puts its little impregnating sucker on this woman that you see. She stands up. She walks across the kitchen, and as she walks, she goes through all nine months of a pregnancy in one shot. So the thing starts growing and growing, and you're like, oh my God, what is happening? She falls on the ground, and she gives birth to a fully grown man. And it is the most fucked up shit I've ever seen in any movie. Udo Kier being born.
I'm so glad you were able to discern a plot out of this movie. Because this is one of those, like, I love wild. Extra. What's it about? I have no goddamn clue.
It's about parenting.
But it's wild to watch.
And then he grows up and tries to take his kid with him back. He wants to take his son back with him. And his son has powers. And at some point, there's weird Black Panther in the movie that apparently the producer forced them to put in. Who knows? Sometimes those moments still make the movie sweeter. But honestly, there are just, if you've never seen this one, this will be pure joy.
This is not a, like, invite the family over for a warm horror movie night. Yeah. This gets weird and uncomfortable. So, yeah.
In all the good ways. Like,
not exactly a date movie unless your date's really cool.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, you look like a cool crowd. So that's Extra. So we have one that was so obvious. In fact, I'm wearing the t-shirt that is a shared Uber number one.
Yes.
Because it is the greatest practical effects next to The Thing of all time in terms of body horror.
Yeah. And that is Society.
Society.
So Elric and I hosted a screening of Society last year at Phoenix Fan Fest the night before I broke my tooth in half.
Yeah.
So yeah, and this one, I've seen this movie so many times and I forget the impact of it and that it is not well known, and just hearing the gasps in the theater during the last 20 minutes.
Almost no one had seen it in the theater which was amazing.
It was probably 100 people in the theater and like two people had seen it. And so we were like, we're going to say nothing. Let's just go in. And just hearing the gasps in the final moment.
Because
was
it's basically
wonderful.
It's a pretty goofy comedy and it's kind of awkward and doesn't.
It feels really 80s.
Yeah, it feels
kind of
almost like a bad comedy for 80% of it. And then with bits of satire in there. And then when it just gets to the end, it's a rich versus the poor, rich literally eating the poor metaphor at the end of this film, and you literally see people turned inside out. You see a mass shunt. I mean, everything you could imagine do to a human body, you get to see at the end of this film, for good or bad. And, you know, bless Brian Yuzna for showing us what otherwise we could never have seen. What more do we want from movies?
Thank you, Screaming Mad George.
Yeah, Screaming Mad George. Yes, there's an effects guy who really deserves credit. He's still making incredible art. He's a surrealist. He teaches at the University of Japan.
University of Tokyo.
Yeah, but I mean, he's one of those figures. And when he was working in America, you saw some wild shit from his imagination.
Oh, yeah.
And I love that because that's a big part of it. It's coming from their imagination. This is not real science, a lot of this stuff. We had a couple quick other influences. Well, you know. Human Centipede we didn't mention, and that is 100% accurate, apparently. So we'll rush through just a couple other influences, and then we're going to, just for a few minutes, bring up a special guest. These are some other influences.
So I am a huge graphic novel fan. I read so many graphic novels, but that's where I find a lot of my body horror, a lot of stuff that I wish people would bring to screen. But again, we get into it's hard to get people to give money to batshit crazy ideas. So basically anything Junji Ito has ever done is a hard sell on screen. We did get a film version of Uzumaki. I've heard rumors there may be like a Holes anthology, but we'll see. And then we've had Tomy, but some of his crazier ones, and even Uzumaki did not push it nearly as far as the graphic novel did. And so just kind of this beautiful body horror of everything. This is from the actual Uzumaki comic. And then over here, Black Hole, I know we both love.
Yeah, well, just Charles Burns, and this is one of those things you've heard every couple years, David Fincher owns the rights, or this person owns the rights. Just when I read this when it first came out,
so much.
It's like literally you've opened to some John Hughes missing movie that just happens to be about like weird STD, you know, transformations and very subtle stuff, like a girl with a tail. You're about to hook up with a girl, and then you just notice a little tail in the back, and it's like, oh, that might not be good. And what could that lead to? Should I do this? I'm going to do it anyway. Okay, what the hell?
The whole setup of it is so smart in that it's this, I've had sex. And so everybody does it, and it's all about kind of getting the mutation and what it does to the body and people being like, this is like my badge of honor, showing I boned somebody, whereas other people are very off-put by it and trying to hide it from their parents. And so it really functions really smart within this kind of John Hughes Pretty in Pink realm. And it's
I love how romantic you use the word boned.
Boned somebody. It's like true. No, but that's how it is presented in the movie, where it's like guys leaning on cars with their newly mutated forehead showing what happened last night. So yeah, it's but it is kind of that high school mentality of sex.
And it's very, if you haven't ever like cracked open something like this, like it's so cinematic. I mean, it looks like you're watching reading a storyboard for a movie. It's mostly just imagery. And then you mentioned games.
The one that I included here, just because, I find a lot of body horror through game. And this one, no one loves, and no one loved at the time when it came out, but I've always been so affected by it. There was one called Phantasmagoria that I remember just absolutely loving. But this is Clive Barker's game, Jericho, which no one played. Has anyone in here played it?
Yay.
Two, three people. Exactly.
Now we know what your interview will be,
Maddie. This game, I wrote a love letter to it on, it may have been the Fango site, on some horror site, but I wrote a love letter to it. It was very plotty. It was about war. There was a lot about war. There was a lot of character drama. Most of the game was structured around this really heavy, dramatic war political plot as they kind of unearth these otherworldly beings, and it gets kind of hellraisery. But it was so body horror that I would sit through these incredibly long, dry discussions about who's currently controlling this enemy base and why we need to secure this border so that I could get to the shit like this. And it was total Clive Barker, but the political and the war stuff really was creating the mythos of it. So it's kind of like, if you think Hellraiser is pretty damn political, I mean, if you actually like follow the original Hellraiser mythos in the books, it's all about this battle between hell and all of the different levels of hell, and these guys are the minions, and oh, you're the Cenobites, but up here's Leviathan, and you know, this fight for power, and it was all of this political stuff. So it's basically that in this kind of deserty war zone. And it did not play well as a video game. If you imagine trying to play like the battles of Hellraiser Hell as a video game, may not be the most riveting thing ever. You know, how are you going to systematically take down Leviathan from the inside? But that said, we would occasionally get these amazing glimpses of body horror that just were wonderful.
And then we'll just rush through a couple quick deep cuts for those at making a list or want to see stuff. Up top, we have very unfortunate gynecologist in Teeth.
I don't think he was that unfortunate.
Well, he's lost his fingers. That's what I mean. I don't care about him. He might have worked at USC.
I love this movie.
Okay.
What the
You know what I'm referring to.
Topical.
Yeah, why not? But you put this one down as a deep cut.
I did. I love Teeth. This movie, when it came out, we had just gotten this, Ginger Snaps was around this same time period, and it was just this kind of wonderful, before we had female filmmakers kind of doing it for themselves, this kind of explosion of, hey, we deserve a voice in this, don't we? And so I'm glad Stacey got that amusing. That was my singe for the day that no one else got. It was just this kind of beautiful moment of like, hey, women have shit going on too. And Teeth was a great moment of that, about a woman who has teeth inside of her vagina and has had a lot of traumatic experiences throughout her life and uses them to her advantage sometimes. And other times she can't control them.
Which kind of feels like it would have been at home in Black Hole as well, that storyline.
Yeah,
I'd say. We also both love the French film Baby Blood, which is finally available in a good release.
Yes.
Which is nice.
So Baby Blood is down here on the lower right. And this one is about a woman who is in this abusive relationship. She gets pregnant, and so she totally bails. She's a circus performer, and she runs away from the circus, which is contrary to what you usually do, because she's pregnant and doesn't want her crazy husband getting near her. And as she takes off running, the fetus starts talking to her, and she realizes that she's not pregnant with a baby, but an alien. Which
well, I don't
is
know if she knows what it is. I don't.
She just knows that
but it's some sort of cosmic entity that's been around forever or something.
Yeah, and it's talking to her and telling her to feed on people, that it requires blood. And so she has to start eating people in order to feed this thing growing inside her. Now, here's a fun one. In the American dub, there is an American dub. Yeah. The alien is voiced by Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
I kid you fucking not.
Oscar winner, so, Gary Oldman.
Oscar winning Gary Oldman. Her belly alien is voiced by Gary Oldman, which has this dry snark, which I've never figured out if it's in the original script, but it is this very dry humor, snarky alien talking to her the entire time. And
same character as the professional. Bring me everyone. That's what he's doing in that film.
So yeah, but it's a wild trip.
Yeah, no, the last 20 minutes is about as gory as it gets. And really, it's actually a really good little movie, widely unseen. And one that's super obscure still, I'd say, and this is the hardest last name on earth to say, Lucille Hadalinovic, something like that. All I know is it was Gaspar Noé. Editor for a long time, also his partner. I think she is an even better filmmaker. I mean, she's made two films. One's called Innocence. It's one of the best films I've ever seen. And then this film from a couple years ago, and it's this art
Evolution.
House. Evolution, yeah. It's this art house. It feels like it's set in some Greek fishing village, but all you see are mothers and their sons. There's no men in this society, and it's these boys swim. This boy at the start discovers this dead body floating, and it has a starfish on its stomach, and they're like, oh, here's a dead boy. And they take this other boy in for surgery, and they put something in his stomach. And then you start to realize that all is not, like, at one point they start staying up at night looking at what their mothers are doing, and they're like a coven of witches almost out in the ocean together doing something. And it becomes this very strange surgical reversing of the evolutionary chain, with young boys being the ones who are able to do things that traditionally women are being able to do. And it is very uncanny, and it's really beautifully made, though. So it's not as gross maybe as it might sound, but it's a mysterious film. It's a film that's very hard to pinpoint, but it's on Netflix. It was released on Netflix. I don't think probably finished very often on Netflix, if I was to guess.
Yeah, and I will add to that, because I would say that it is not very commonly finished, because you recommended this one to me, and about an hour in, I was like, oh God, I'm so bored. Would someone just do something? And then the last act of the movie explodes, and I was so glad I stuck with it. So I will tell you before going in, just stick with it. It gets crazy.
Yeah, different types of movie. Yeah. But those are deep cuts. So, you know, don't be afraid to let your body die. That's the message.
It's going to happen whether you want to or not.
Of the show, yeah. And to end the show, we love going to festivals. We're just going to have a few minutes with a filmmaker that we became aware of because he listened to the show.
And we found him on socials.
And it was very exciting because, Patty Murphy had a new film that was on festival circuit, and he met a friend of mine in the UK at Fright Fest. And it's always exciting to get to, you know, talk to you guys. So come on down, Patty Murphy. Or as they say about Charlie Murphy, motherfucker Murphy. All right.
Thank you so much for joining us.
This is very surreal. I'm not going to lie.
Well, let's start with body horror before we pivot to your movie. What influences body horror on you or on your films?
The first ones I kind of quickly touch on From Beyond is one of my favorites.
I know, we should have mentioned it.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
You're bulging hypothalamus.
Yeah. It's
pineal. It's pineal
right
in
here,
that one.
But even just Barbara is so amazing in that. Like, it's just a great role for her. There's two that I'm going to touch on in a second because they're directly related to what I wanted to do with my movie. But I don't know if this counts as body horror because it's a werewolf movie. But I mean, werewolf transformations.
It's the ultimate
in the Company of Wolves by Nia Jordan, which is one of my
pulling favorite. Beautiful
off,
yeah. With
the transformations
from the mouth.
That are some of the greatest I've ever seen. Yeah. And I just love Nia Jordan. I think what he does is incredible. And then the two that I'll talk about that I feel are kind of related to my movie, and you touch on them both in this. One is The Brood. Because to me, there's no better representation of, as you say, like manifesting emotion, which is something that we try to do in The Perished as well. And Hellraiser, which is, when I was 12, I saw it, and it was definitely a point where I didn't, like you said, didn't understand all the psychosexual.
I had no fucking clue what was going on, but there was a dude without
the
S&M. Skin.
There was just like, oh, that dude's got nails in his face. That's so cool. And then, but I literally wore the VHS tape out. I watched it so much. And I've been lucky enough to work with Nicholas Vince, who played Chatterer a bunch of times. And he's just a sweet, wonderful man as well. which is, and he hates horror movies. I love that. I'm like, this guy was a horror icon, and he's terrified of horror movies.
And this is your first time in America, right?
This is my first time ever in the U.S.
Ate chicken and waffles this morning, so you have completed your trip, sir.
That's it, journey complete. Yeah, that's all I came here to do, actually.
Do you feel it? Do you feel it? Because it's going to stick with you for 2 days now.
I'm going to carry it with, this is my body horror journey. Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about Parrish, because we haven't seen it yet. We're going to leave right as it's screening, so we're going to have to watch it in alternate ways. But yeah. This is something I heard about at Fright Fest and was excited about. I love the cover art that you had.
Oh, yeah. That was Christopher Shaw, who was just an amazing artist. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of the Dead Space graphic novels, which yet again, talking about horror video games. Like,
I love Dead Space.
It's incredible. Even just the iconography of his spine with the lights and everything.
I did an interview with one of the guys who did the effects, and he put so much care into literally figuring out how a severed foot would rotate in space, and it, just listening to him talk about it, I was like, it's fucking art. It's brilliant. And then you watch it and you're like, oh my god. Yeah,
it's
so they're
good.
Great.
But Chris was amazing. The Perished is very much about, it's a social horror first and foremost, about something that Ireland was going through 2 to 3 years ago, which is still happening in a lot of places. I kind of forgot that when I met it. I thought this might be relevant in Ireland now that we've passed an abortion rights law. But I forgot that there's plenty of places that are still dealing. And even in Ireland, where that's been passed, opinions don't change because of a vote. Like, and
hey,
still,
we know that. Feel
well,
it, guys.
Be relevant to here, yeah.
Like 41% of our country still feels the same way, and probably a lot more that don't talk about it. But yeah, the film is about a young woman who finds herself pregnant and decides she, at the time it was illegal in Ireland to have an abortion, so she goes to the UK. When she comes back, everyone hates her, effectively. Mm. And she's kind of cast out by her parents. Her boyfriend breaks up with her. And her best friend, who's here, he's Paul Fitzgerald, who's an amazing actor.
Hi, best friend.
Decides to do the nice thing and help her recover an old country home, which happens to be, it's a word that doesn't get used here, which is parochial house, which is an old priest's house. He brings her there to recover, which he thinks he's being good, but the house is built on top of a mass baby grave of 800 babies. And their spirits are looking for a mother, and it causes all kinds of body malfunctions. And the funniest part is one of the producers that I pitched the film to said, it's really good, but this 800 babies thing, it's a bit over the top, a little bit ridiculous. I was like, no, this is the one part of the movie that's true. This happened.
Wow.
They discovered a mass baby grave that had 800 babies in it. And that was, I was like, if that's not real horror, like I can't think of what is.
So has it played in Ireland yet?
Yes, it played there in October. That was, of all the screenings I've been at, that was the one where I was nervous.
Was it really controversial, intense?
Yeah. Like, luckily, I mean, it went down very well because I think, again, the audience that was there for it was very much a progressive, open-minded audience. But at the same time, going up, I was like, oh, God, if there's anyone here that feels a certain way. But at the same time, I tried to make sure that the film is not preachy because that is the last thing you want to do, because you want to include everyone in the discussion. But kind of still articulate, like, this is what a person is going through, and try and be empathetic, try and see things from their perspective a little bit. So,
how about Fright Fest? Because obviously, London's obviously a totally different crowd, but so close.
It was amazing. Any screens, I've had 3 screens in the UK, and a lot of them are young crowds. And when it plays, they're like, I didn't understand that this was an issue for people. They were like, here it's not. If I was pregnant tomorrow, that's an option for me. Mm-hmm. They were like, so to think that you've lived your, I'm 36 now, so they're like, up to, for 33 years of your life in that country, that is not an option for people. And they're like, that's insane. And then to also feel that, like, if you do that, you are literally carrying the shame and guilt of an entire country on your back when you come home. I've had people come up to me after screenings and say, it's been 30 years, I've never told anybody that I had an abortion because I was so scared to, and this is the first time I've ever spoke about it publicly, which was, to me, that's why I wanted to make the movie, was to allow people to share that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's why I love horror.
Yeah.
Exactly. Horror should be about talking about real
open up things,
Yeah, and discussions. And it's funny because something Becky said a minute ago about the film Evolution. I sometimes feel like that with The Parish, where it's like, I hope people stick with it because it does. It's a character drama first and foremost. I always reference that 2 of the biggest influences on it are Don't Look Now and The Changeling. Mm-hmm. So it can be a little bit slow. But we get there. And when we get there, going back to body horror, some of my favorite reviews out of Fright Fest, because it's been very well received, thankfully, compared it to Hellraiser, which, as I say, you don't even realize that you're putting your influences in your work when you do, but You are, of course.
So where will listeners of this, in the USA, especially North America, be able to see it? Do you know yet?
I do know that it is getting a release here through the Horror Collective, which so grateful and so happy and thankful, because there's always that fear. You're like, I've just sunk everything into this. Please say I get distribution, which you spoke about in your Nightmare
University. I spoke about that micro-budget. You are literally willing to die on the fire that might be your movie. But it's worth it.
It's so worth it. But yeah, I know that it's being released by the Horror Collective. I don't have a specific date yet, but what I keep saying is quarter one, quarter two, 2020.
Okay.
But just if you follow facebook.com/theparishmovie, that's where all the info is. So.
Well, I'm glad we could include you. It's good
yes,
to have you.
Yes, thank you so much for coming
so
on, Patty.
So honored. You don't even understand.
We'll make this a longer interview when you're out now.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I would be
thanks
there.
For coming with us. Well, thank you guys for listening
thank
so much.
Thank you guys so
glad
much.
Glad we could bring it down.
You can find us online, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, Shockwaves, and in the words of David Cronenberg, please like and review us.
He's got a gun.
Thank you guys. Enjoy Panic Fest. Thank you.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Sanier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pesetta, and Rob Galuzzo.